Edvinka is an investment company exclusively dedicated to education. Edvinka is the fruit of a joint venture between Hambro Perks, the growth investment firm behind PyTop and Cortext, and DLF Venture, a family-owned holding company affiliated to Verdinvest, who have invested in some of the most successful edtech companies in Asia, like Baijiu's. At Edvinka, our aim is to help edtech startups make large-scale impact. We are active investors who like to think global. We invest in early-stage companies that we grow alongside their founders. We offer follow-on funding and deploy permanent capital to address our long-term vision. Please visit our website on www.edvinka.com to find out more about our mission, and get in touch on info@edvinka.com if you want to discuss your edtech business with us.
Here's a word from Class Central, the most popular search and review site for online courses. If you've ever gone on the hunt for a great online course from a top university, then you may already know about Class Central. Class Central is the most comprehensive search engine for MOOCs and online courses. The site lists over 10,000 courses and allows you to search by subject, university, keyword, and language of instruction. With tens of thousands of user reviews, you can use Class Central to help you decide if a course is right for you. And if you're into geeking out about online learning like I am, you'll love diving into Class Central's MOOC report. The MOOC report covers everything that's going on in the MOOC space, with news, analysis, and opinions about the fascinating world of online courses. A great place to start is with Class Central's in-depth analysis of the state of MOOCs in 2017. You can find a link in our show notes. Or if you're interested in finding out which courses are ranked the highest, check out Class Central's course rankings for the month and the year, or have a look at the top 50 MOOCs of all time. Hi everyone, what's going on this week? Well, London EdTech Week have announced their first round of programmes for June, and I'd also definitely recommend checking out the London Festival of Learning, also in London, in June. Applications are now open for pitches, exhibits and books to showcase at the EdTech Podcast Festival in September. You can find out how to enter via the show notes, or sign up to our newsletter and keep your eyes peeled. I'm also keen to connect with SLT teachers or lecturers making high impact in education who'd like to share their knowledge in some of our masterclasses. This week, the EdTech Podcast Festival is excited to confirm past guests Ian Dunn, Deputy VC at Coventry University, and Michelle Thomas, Exec Head Teacher at the New Wave Federation in Hackney, as speakers. What else? Well, I've moved my son into a new nursery, fingers crossed, which means that I'm on term time, baby. So you might start to see podcast publications sync up with UK half terms and summer holidays. But then again, it's me and I've rarely been known not to hit that publish button. So let's see how we all get on. Moving on to this week's podcast. This week's podcast features a recording from this year's South by Southwest EDU, where I interviewed general all-round Duracell bunny Bridget Burns of the University Innovation Alliance. Bridget spoke to me about how universities can focus on better student experience and value through better collaboration and less walled garden approaches. If you're familiar with JISC in the UK, you may be reminded of some similar methodologies, though I'd love to hear your thoughts as usual. So get tweeting, emailing, or send in a voicemail for inclusion. Thanks to Edvinka and Class Central for sponsoring this week's episode, and to listener and past guest English teacher Obi Matten, who said of last week's episode, "Loving this episode, perfect maternity CPD for me right now, lots of projects to pursue." I'm glad you found it useful, OB. Big congrats on the newbie and thanks for sending your thoughts in. Have a great week, everyone. So I'm here now with Bridget Burns, the Executive Director for the University Innovation Alliance. So welcome, Bridget.
Thanks for having me.
And Bridget, I was enjoying your tweet earlier about, EdSurge had promoted your session here this afternoon. So that's good in many ways, but piles the pressure on
terrifying.
As well. So just to start with, perhaps you could tell our listeners a little bit about who you are and what you do and what you'll be talking about in that session as well.
So I help universities share ideas about how to help low-income students and to scale up proven interventions and innovations across the country. So I work with 11 large public research universities in the U.S., all over 25,000 students, some of the most innovative in the country, who in 2013 came together and the presidents and chancellors united around a sense of urgency that we're not doing a good enough job producing college degrees in the United States to meet the future economic demand. We're doing a pretty terrible job when it comes to low-income, first-generation, and students of color. And going it alone to solve those two important challenges is a waste of time, energy, and money. So my campuses have found ways to create our own version of collaboration that actually serves the campuses and helps them move faster together. And we set ambitious goals. We do transparent data sharing. They match every dollar philanthropically raised. And in 3 years' time, we've managed to increase our low-income degrees by 25%. So they're making significant progress, and we're being able to scale a lot of different innovations. And now we're pivoting to try and ignite a broader movement where other campuses feel ready to take this up and to form their own collaboratives and to feel empowered to connect with our work and add to it. And
That's very interesting because in the UK, if I understand correctly, I think Oxford has actually gone backwards in terms of, what you've just been talking about and submitting students from that background and actually getting the degrees through. So, I mean, sort of 3 years ago, is that what you were experiencing here? Is that kind of what catalyzed this movement?
Yeah, well, so basically the rewards are all on the wrong things. So if you want to move up in the prestige measures that are commonly associated with higher ed, if you want to move in the rankings or anything, usually those are going to be placing higher emphasis on exclusivity and not necessarily on whether you're serving vulnerable populations, but rather how many people you turn away, how many people apply, and therefore how sexy you are. Some campuses actually find the higher their price point is, that's considered a status measure for quality. And I mean, it's just not real. It's a lot of hype and it's a lot of fake. And it's especially concerning because it is placing an emphasis on the exact opposite of what the future economic competitiveness of our country and the world really is going to require. If you look at the growing inequality gap, if you look at what's going on in terms of social mobility, we should all be concerned about this and trying to do a better job. And the campuses who don't, I don't actually believe it's that they don't care. I think it's that we have the wrong reward system. The emphasis is all based on individual behavior. Campuses move up individually. And also, if they do move up, it's usually for things like exclusivity. And there's not really a huge emphasis, especially when we started, on improving how well you serve a student regardless of their background. And we have some compelling examples. For instance, Georgia State is one of our campuses, and they, in a span of 7 years, they doubled their graduation rate. They eliminated race and income as a predictor of outcome. So they're one of the only campuses in the world who's done that, and not by cherry picking or limiting the number of people coming in. And when they did that, they went down in the U.S. News rankings by 10 spots. So we know that even when you do this thing that we know the country needs, we know the world needs more of, that the existing reward structures and incentives are placing an emphasis on the wrong things.
It reminds me, I see a lot of chat about in the UK, our kind of regulator that goes in and checks the success of schools. If you have a head that's moved to, say, a school in a challenging circumstance, and then that's reflected in their Ofsted rating, it reflects on the career of that person, on the school itself. But actually there can be a lot of amazing work happening there, but it's sort of in those more challenging circumstances, and the kind of ranking system doesn't always reflect what's actually happening.
No, it doesn't.
So in terms of the universities that you have in your alliance, what kind of innovations are they doing where, it is making a difference and you'd like to share, because perhaps people listening in can learn from that as well?
So in the first 4 years, we've managed to scale up a series of interventions that have been proven out somewhere else, right? So there's plenty of innovation going on. And what we really struggle with in higher ed is scale. There's a lot of tinkering in silos. There's a lot of repeated experiments and a lot of, you know, just not a connected, innovative strategy to diffuse what's been proven already. So what we do is we, once something's really been proven out at a specific threshold that everyone feels like, yes, that's a real thing, that's actually causing not just statistically significant increase, but it's there are other ways that you can vet these things. So the first year we did a capacity scaling project, which was we scaled up this program at Arizona State called the University Initiatives. They call them the UI University Initiatives Fellows. And we created something called the University Innovation Alliance Fellows, which is basically trying to create an entirely different door into senior leadership in higher ed and have it be highly representative. But essentially, one of the huge areas that's missing, if you talk about campuses trying to innovate, it's they need more people who are skilled at project management, at shepherding change. It's own skill. It deserves its own workforce, right?
And are you finding universities starting to have that kind of change management person to action that, or?
All of our campuses do. We have these fellows, but we're starting to see other people try and replicate this, which is awesome because we need more people. Pretending that higher ed is naturally inclined towards change is obtuse, and you actually need people who are really focusing on this. The second year we did predictive analytics, which is essentially identifying based on historical data how you have been getting in the way of student success in the past and actually setting up a series of indicators based on those ways that you are getting in the way. So, you know, there are a number of different things that you could use. Card swipe data, you could, you know, students registering for the wrong class, students not showing up for their advising appointment, students changing majors. There are all kinds of things that based on historical data, if you look back, you could know that, yes, that was the red flag, that if we caught that, we would have stopped that student from dropping out. Well, every campus can do that, finding the right vendor or building the right system. And so once you set it up so that instead of most campuses being reactionary and just kind of, you know, we find out when our graduation rates go down, we find out when our dropout rates go higher. If you could instead anticipate and intervene the second that one of those red flags goes off, then you can be proactive. And that makes a transformative difference.
Yeah, we have in the UK, the kind of shared technology for a lot of the universities is via JISC. So they have a learner analytics system that goes across loads of universities in the UK for the same reason, to look at a student's pathway and identify where they may be at risk of dropping out and that kind of thing. I just wondered, among your alliance members, whether there is a sort of shared tool or a shared system that can provide those metrics in a kind of standardized form, or whether they use different systems, but ultimately they all kind of count towards the same thing that help you identify and reduce that from happening.
So we have a data sharing agreement that we hammered out, that we figured out what metrics we were going to measure. And, you know, that was a lot of different work in the first year, but essentially we focus on the delta in outcomes between low and high income students. So that's really what we're trying to eliminate. And now also we're adding, you know, race and ethnicity. So that's for the UIA. But in terms of our campuses sharing data, we're sharing to the point that some of our campuses are sharing student unit record level data, and they all have their own system. And I recommend that. So that's happening in the US, where there's a few dominant providers. And just in the end, I think there needs to be much more diversity in the market, because every campus has a story about why they're not going to do X with Y company, mm-hmm. right? And we need more options out there, because everyone needs to do this. It's hard. And unfortunately, many presidents and chancellors, they hear about this and they go home and they say, okay, we're going to do predictive analytics like it's a light switch. But it's actually a really hard road. You know, when we started out, we had 3 campuses with predictive analytics, and now we have 10. But it's not like we have 10 that are all at the same mark. There are some that are very early on still, because it's quite hard getting through the silos. They have disparate systems that don't communicate. And some of them have actually switched vendors. So you need to have that diversity in the market. But yes, we found that we couldn't actually share a lot of this data across multiple platforms. So instead, we created our own cloud-based sharing platform that was the brainchild of Tim Renick at Georgia State. He created something called REDCap. And it's because we're doing a 10,000 student random control trial for our third year scale project, which is proactive advising.
Did you found this alliance? How did you get into doing this?
So I'm very fortunate that I had a prior career helping university presidents and chancellors in a different capacity in state policy. And I was a chief of staff for a system. So I hired my first college president when I was 22. So I'm not super intimidated by the position. And I instead really have a lot of empathy for it. And I understand the challenges of that position. And so I'm one of those people who, I don't think that we need more people aspiring to be college presidents. We need more people who make them effective. So I was trying to figure out what my next challenge was going to be. And I had come to this very clear conclusion that there was something really problematic around collaboration, that this elbow throwing constantly between campuses, despite us being allegedly on the same side, there was something really messed up about that. And we need to figure out how to make it so that collaboration was less painful. And I wanted to understand whether or not the campuses who claim to be innovative, if there's really something different there. And so I went and did an ACE fellowship at Arizona State, which is, you know, the most innovative campus in the country under the most innovative president. And when I got there, they were trying to simultaneously figure this out. He'd met with a lot of these presidents. They were starting to talk about, could we come up with something together? Could we build something around scale? So I've just very fortunately showed up with the right background at the right moment when they were looking for someone to help with this. And I was free labor because I was an ACE fellow. So for a year, my whole fellowship was about building this and prototyping it and helping it get it stood up and then raising enough money to get it launched. And at the conclusion of my fellowship, I just didn't go home.
And so how many years ago was that?
That was in 2013. And 2014 was our first. We launched in 2014, September.
And do you have any ambitions to connect internationally with either international campuses of your universities and or domestic campuses? So I'm just thinking of those in the UK or beyond there.
So first off, we're engaging in what I would describe as a public experiment, that we are prototyping and showing that this is possible, that you can work together with a group of campuses who you didn't know. And frankly, nobody thought this was going to work. And you can find a way to work together, to move faster and to scale and ultimately close your achievement gaps across the country. So we have not done that yet. We're making great efforts. We've seen great progress, but we have not, you know, the bell has not been rung. So in the meantime, more than 100 campuses have said, we want to join. So we are trying to figure out, how do we not destroy the experiment, which we know the intimacy matters. How do we open a window so that people can participate in this to feel part of it? So we're holding a national summit next month. It's our first time where we've opened a door or a window for other campuses. And so that's coming in Atlanta. And we already have more than 50 campuses who are coming. And so part of it is we're going to teach them our way of bringing people together, which is fundamentally unlike any other kind of event or convening you would go to.
What do you think is unique about it?
It's like a flipped classroom model. So conferences, people come as individuals and they go home with a laundry list of ideas that they will probably not follow up on. And it's not designed for action. So this is much more riffing on how people would actually try and improve themselves. So flipped classroom model, no keynotes, no panels, 7-minute talks, failure sharing, off the record time, team time. You have to come as a team. So it's really designed for campus leaders to send a team. We don't actually want presidents and chancellors there. We think that the people who are doing the work on the ground should be the ones who are coming together. And we want to create a shared sense of connection, and that people are not alone, and that they will know who to actually call and be able to follow up with. You know, what we find is that the dumb question that most people are afraid to ask is actually the most powerful question. So you want to create an environment where people will ask that question, because then it betrays that other people on your campus have been struggling with that same thing that has yet to be said out loud on your campus. And so that's how we're scaling it right now. But we've already had lots of others try and replicate this work, and we're super excited about that. We think that this needs to be a movement, not a club, but we have not succeeded yet. So therefore, we're not just, okay, move on to the next.
Yeah. So technology-wise, it's quite interesting, because one of the sessions I did attend here was on MOOCs and the evolution of MOOCs and sort of who actually accesses that. And I think from recent research, it just sort of shows that it's usually people who've already benefited from a degree who then kind of go and continue to access further learning through MOOCs. I just wondered whether there are other things outside of the learner analytics that you think will help to close this gap as well.
So I think part of what we need to focus on is the way that we teach about innovative teaching strategies should probably start looking like the innovative teaching strategies that we are telling teachers to teach with. So pedagogy applied to how we share ideas is one of those things. So we have a lot of innovative practices that we're seeing that the evidence is still yet to fully bear out. So one is adaptive learning. We're seeing promising ideas there. We're seeing promising examples and experiments, but we need to see that kind of a little further along. I shared that we've done predictive analytics, proactive advising. We're doing completion grants now, which is these small grants that we give to students who are on the cusp of dropping out in their senior year, and then provide kind of wraparound services to get them through the finish line. So these are all very hands-on things. They're not as whiz-bang and high-tech as people want to hear about when your middle name is innovation, but there's interesting stuff going on in VR. It's all very early, I would say. And so it's important for us to set up environments for us to actually really test the efficacy of these things. You know, we need to learn from past mistakes. Part of the reason the sector has not innovated is not just that the diffusion of innovation is in itself ripe for innovation, but it's also that, you know, it's like we deal with efficacy research, you know, 20 years later. Yeah, we've been doing this practice for, you know, a really long time, but yet, no, we've actually not done a study because we just know that it works. Well, I mean, that's not good enough. So an example is proactive advising.
I suppose that brings me on to the big question, which is, you know, are universities really the right kind of institution to deliver some of this? Some people would question, you know, and that's where we see other service providers popping up, whether it's kind of coding boot camps or whether it's kind of micro degrees, that kind of thing. What are your members telling you, and what's your kind of thoughts on that?
I mean, the idea that it's either or is just problematic. I think we need all of it. I think we need a vibrant marketplace with a lot of different experimentation and testing and validation. And it, I mean, people just love to make these wide sweeping claims about, oh, this is the future of this, and therefore universities are going away. Well, listen, universities are pretty good at lasting. We've been around since before the church, so I'm pretty confident that there are some other kind of social factors that lead to these organizations sticking around. They're going to adapt, they're going to evolve, and I think that many of these alternative providers should see themselves as an adaptation or as a supplement. And there's just so much that we need to still figure out yet. And I think that the hostility and the territorial nature between the adults is like such a waste of energy and time. It's like, I mean, listen, I get that it's like super cool to talk trash about the value of a college degree right now. It's like super in. But we actually have the historical data that shows that this is still a worthwhile investment for people. And that doesn't mean that we can't consider alternative modes. We can't consider alternative supplements or new programs and new college alternatives. You don't need to destroy the building to try and improve it. You know, so MOOCs, like, awesome. It's a great supplement, turns out. It's a great way to flip your classroom. It's a great way to do continuing education. It's a great way to make that claim about the lifelong learner a reality. So yeah, less hyperbole.
Yeah, I agree. In the UK, we have like the Teaching and Excellence Framework. I don't know if you've heard about this, but basically it's now, I suppose, the traditional rankings that we were talking about are more generally geared towards excellence in research. And these new rankings are about sort of more student-centered and, you know, actually how high quality is the teaching? How much does it use different methods of delivering the subjects, etc. I just wondered, for people listening in that are less familiar with the US higher education system, whether there have been any either policy changes or initiatives that they should know about that are similar in terms of gearing things towards being more student-centered.
Yeah, I mean, the state policy innovation space, there's a lot going on. People keep holding up Tennessee as a kind of the landmark state for that. And then you're seeing a lot of these ideas tested out in terms of focusing on the learner. There's a lot more student success legislation. There's, you know, the free college movement. There's just all of this stuff happening. And what it does happen state by state in the U.S. And then it goes through something called the National Conference of State Legislatures and then a National Governors Association. So like once something's been proven out, then we're starting to see it kind of take off. But I would say for things like that in higher ed in the U.S., we see a new ranking almost every year come out. And I think that's another way that they're trying to supplement it, where it's not just using policy. People are trying different angles at measuring learning outcomes, at measuring the impact on a student's life. You're seeing Raj Chetty and John Friedman's work out of Stanford and Brown, where they're doing measurement over social mobility over time. And so I think there are going to be some potential policy outcomes. It's still very early relative to those things. So yeah, it's all good. It's all, you know, again, less hyperbole, like we've cracked this nut and all of a sudden, you know, blow up the building. No, it's just, it's all more information. It's more nuance. And we're adding a greater understanding of how we shift policy, how we shift what we incentivize to reward what really matters.
And just finally, so we have a book club as part of the podcast, so where guests recommend certain books that they have read that have influenced how they think or which direction they've taken in life, I suppose. And it doesn't have to be necessarily in direct relation to your work, but are there any kind of books, people, resources, people you follow on Twitter that you'd like to share with our listeners as well?
So I like to look to relatively non-traditional spaces for inspiration about how the future of learning within my sector happens. So I like to look to, you know, different spaces where, especially how people are doing growth, whether it's personal development, otherwise. So one thing that, like, for me has been an inspiration that people think is kind of weird is we're trying to build a national community of practice. And I think that the most effective community of practice that's out there that's for improvement science is Weight Watchers. Most people are like, oh, that's really weird. Well, it's actually
a network, isn't it?
It's a massive network. It breaks down how you actually create a system where people have self-ownership over their own transformation about the thing that is the hardest thing, right? Losing weight's hard. Well, changing schools and changing institutions and change is hard too. So the rules are the same, which is, you know, you have to sign up. No one can sign you up. Transparent data sharing. You weigh yourself once a week. There's not shaming. There's praise when you make progress. And then people share what they're really struggling with in it. Intimate community of practice. So I think that's pretty inspiring and interesting. I like to look at other places like what we're seeing in the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, 100,000 Lives Initiative. There's a lot of transformation in the healthcare space that has, you know, a decade ahead of higher ed in terms of helping shepherd change at scale across highly competitive, similarly sized organizations. In terms of a book, I wouldn't pick a higher ed book. Like, I've worked with 30 different college presidents and chancellors at this point, and I understand how organizations can really get inside the box. And so I would recommend the book Leadership and Self-Deception. I have every fellow read it as they start. I always recommend it at multiple points in people's careers because over time you really start to self-justify your choices. And I think that organizations also experience self-justification, and helping to create spaces where people are outside the box is really important.
Well, and if people are listening in, they'd like to follow up with what you do. I think you're quite active on Twitter and that kind of thing. Aside from your website, what's your Twitter handle?
It's bburns.edu.
Okay, fantastic. And then we'll drop the link to your event. But thank you so much for sharing all your insight into what you're doing.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
This week's episode. If you enjoy the EdTech podcast, please consider taking a look at our Patreon site and signing up for just $1 a month. I hope that you get more value than that from each listen, and if enough of you do it, it will be a wonderful thing. If that's not your cup of tea, but you love giving reviews, feel free to post a review on iTunes or Spotify, or share the podcast with an EdTech or Edu friend. That's all for now. We will be back soon with more from South by Southwest EDU and around the world. Bye-bye.